May the words of my mouth and the meditations of all of our hearts be pleasing unto you, O Lord. You may be seated. It's the first Sunday after Thanksgiving. This is the Sunday where they send in substitute preachers. Because they know that a certain percentage of the congregation will still be traveling from the holidays. And therefore, the assumption is that if the substitute preacher really messes things up and does damage, enough of the congregation is traveling that it will be easier to fix. So I have been pressed into service this morning. And I learned there's a really terrible thing about preaching here at St. Francis. You may not be aware of this, but you have to do it twice. And this is the second time. So I have my cup of water, and hopefully we'll make it through together. Today begins Advent. The theme of Advent is expectation or anticipation of the coming of the Christ. Christ is a Greek word that means anointed. One reason you would anoint someone in the ancient world is to commission them, to send them on a mission. So the Christ that we await in Advent is the sent one. The one whom God sent. When we say Jesus Christ, we are not saying a first and a last name. We are saying Jesus, the one whom God sent. God's sent one. To set up the theme of expectation, the first gospel reading every Advent is from an apocalyptic speech in the New Testament. Either an apocalyptic speech by John the Baptist or by Jesus. This year, it's a speech of Jesus from Luke chapter 21. In each of three of the four Gospels, Matthew, Mark, and Luke, Jesus gives one apocalyptic speech. This morning, I want to do two things. The first is I want to put this weird speech by Jesus in context. What is apocalyptic? What is the apocalypse? And then the second thing I want to do is to answer the question, what does this apocalyptic speech by Jesus have to do with us? So the first point, what is apocalyptic? You've all heard the word, I assume. And Jesus took second time you give a sermon in one morning. But in Luke chapter 21, Jesus gets a little weird. He starts talking science fiction. An apocalyptic speech in the Bible, which is centered in Daniel in the Old Testament. And then you get to the end of the New Testament. The apocalypse of the New Testament is primarily in the book of Revelation, also known as the apocalypse of John. And the apocalypse is the apocalyptic parts of the Bible is what Hollywood loves. This is the stuff of the four horsemen of the apocalypse we read about in the book of Revelation, of pestilence and plagues, whatever a pestilence means, the stars falling from the skies, the skies turning blood red, the foundations of the world being shaken. These are the images of the book of Revelation and some of the images in Jesus' speech that we just read. Out of all of this violence, all of these violent images, the book of Revelation states that God will make a new heaven and a new earth. Apocalyptic thinking is parallel to what economists sometimes call creative destruction in a free market economy. Some businesses must go bankrupt, but that creates space for new businesses to arise. So the churning of creative destruction in free market economies. You could say that apocalyptic thinking is creative destruction on a cosmological scale. The world is messed up. And in the apocalyptic thinking of Jesus' day, the Jewish people of Jesus' day looked at the world and they said, this world is so corrupt, so different from God's intentions, that it can't be fixed. You can't go from where we are right now, step by step, reforming and remaking the world until you get a world that meets God's intentions. The world is so corrupt, so distorted, so wrecked, that you have to burn it. You have to melt it down, the same thing you do with metals, to purify them and remove alloys. The world has to be melted down so that God can remake it and remake a new heaven and a new earth that fits God's intentions. The world needs to be melted down, purified, and reconstituted. Underlying apocalyptic is a concern about vindication. That God and God's laws, God's intentions from the world would be vindicated. If the world is such a mess, the U.S. is fighting two wars right now. If the world is such a mess, most of the world's population lives on less than $3 per day. If the world is such a mess, more than 25% of children in the developing world are underweight and therefore stunted. If the world is such a mess, to bring it back home, my business is struggling and I may lose my job. If the world is such a mess, my family is in crisis, my marriage may dissolve. If the world is such a mess, how do we make sense of God? How will God's laws and God's goodness be vindicated? In apocalyptic thinking, God's laws and God's goodness are vindicated at the end of history when God steps from behind the curtain, no longer working behind the scenes, but steps in front of the curtain and remakes the world according to God's intentions. And for ancient Jews, this vindication of God, this apocalypse, would be their vindication as well, because they were the recipients of God's laws. They were the followers of God's laws, which distinguished them from the Romans and the other pagan peoples around them, so that when God entered history, bringing history as we know it to an end, they, as God's people, recipient of God's laws, followers of God's laws, would finally and ultimately be vindicated. So when God comes in judgment, the power of God being realized openly in history, God will choose sides, and it will be their side. In this apocalyptic speech from Luke 21 of Jesus that we read, one interesting thing about it is that the apocalyptic speech that Jesus gives in Matthew, Mark, and Luke is the least original thing that Jesus says in the entire New Testament. It is an amalgam of quotes selected from various parts of the Old Testament and also quotes from literature, Jewish literature, that preceded the birth of Jesus. Jesus is making a collage of quotes from other Jewish literature. He is reflecting back to the people, his listeners, their own apocalyptic expectations in order to transform, in order to redefine those apocalyptic expectations. So Jesus redefines apocalyptic. And if he redefines apocalyptic, my second point is, what does this apocalyptic thinking, this apocalyptic speech of Jesus, have to do with us? In the apocalyptic world that was much of Judaism at the time of Jesus, apocalyptic expressed God's agenda, that God would arrive and step in front of the curtain and remake the world. This was God's agenda in the world and in history. So you would expect, if this is the declaration of God's agenda, that this apocalyptic speech would be at the beginning of the Gospel of Luke. But instead, it comes near the end in chapter 21. And if you go from Jesus' apocalyptic speech directly to the next chapter of Luke, the very next thing that happens is that Judas betrays Jesus. There's the Last Supper. Jesus is arrested. Jesus is placed on trial. Jesus is executed on the cross. In the Gospels, the apocalypse, the melting down and remaking of the world, begins at Jesus' trial and Jesus' death on the cross. And when they put the apocalyptic speech of Jesus directly before his trial, they're pointing and say, this is the moment. Because in apocalyptic language that is so poetic, if you read the book of Revelation, and by the way, ancient people didn't take the book of Revelation literally either. As a matter of fact, there's a scholar at Harvard who's analyzed the language and said, behind the four horsemen of the apocalypse and all these dramatic images, is actually a very subtle criticism of Rome and its politics and how it oppressed people. So why did they use this poetic language to describe Rome? Because if you lived in the Roman Empire, you never attacked Rome directly in your speech and in your language. It was a good way to die. But in this apocalyptic language that in the gospel writers is pointed at the cross, this poetic language talks about the foundations of the world being shaken. What does poetic language about the foundations of the world being shaken mean? It means that our assumptions about life, the fundamental logic of the world, is altered. The fundamental assumptions of life are changed. And for the New Testament writers, it was the death of Jesus that fundamentally changed the world. Because for many ancient Jews, the arrival of God in the apocalypse would be God shouting, "Who's with me?" and then wiping everybody else out. It would be the revelation of God's power in the world. God would separate the good from the bad. Or if Clint Eastwood has it, had it in his version, Clint Eastwood would separate the good, the bad, and the ugly, if you're familiar with that movie. And among those who seemed to be righteous, there would be a lot of collateral damage. Jesus knows that if that was the version of the end of the world, if that was the apocalypse, a lot of us wouldn't make it. And you can look around at the people sitting around you at church this morning. A couple of months ago, I preached a sermon here about the cross, and I talked about the meaning of the cross for those who are suffering, for those who are victimized, for those who feel abandoned by God. But if apocalyptic is the revelation of God's power, at least that's the understanding of it, I want to look at the other side of the meaning of the cross. What does the cross, what does Jesus teach us about power? We all have power. Each of us has areas of influence in our lives where our actions affect other people. You may be a lawyer, a doctor, a teacher, or a policeman. You have power. You have authority. If you don't have a job that gives you obvious authority in certain realms, you may be married or you have a lifelong partner. You are in a relationship, therefore, that gives you considerable influence to impact the course of another human being's life. We all have power. Jim Collins, a management guru, wrote a best-selling book a few years ago called From Good to Great. And in that book, he analyzed corporations that were in the middle of their industry, then they rose to prominence to dominate their industry, and then they continued to dominate their industry for 15 years. And so statistically, he located companies that fit that profile and then asked the question, what made them so successful that they rose to prominence and stayed prominent for at least 15 years? He discovered to his surprise that corporations that hire celebrity CEOs, you remember when Chrysler hired Lee Iacocca. My father was an employee of Chrysler, and he thought that Lee Iacocca should be the next president of the United States back then. But Chrysler rose to prominence, but it didn't stay there. It fell quickly. And companies that hire celebrity CEOs often rise, but then fall like a meteor. The companies that remained great had CEOs that took the blame when things went poorly, praised others when things went well, and supported their staff and employees so that their staff and employees would maximize their potential. Not their productivity, but their potential. Collins, in a footnote in his book, narrates a discussion that he had with his graduate students that helped him do the statistical analysis for his book. And they discussed catchphrases that they could use to describe these CEOs. And one of the catchphrases that they used, or they discussed using, to describe successful CEOs was servant leader. But they decided that servant leader was too loaded to use in a book on business management. Jesus calls us to a model of exercising power that goes beyond management theory, to a fundamental transformation of who we are as people. God's model of power is radical. I would even say subversive. And Jesus modeled it for us. Real power isn't oversight. It isn't power over. Real power is power from below, power underneath, power through service. We tend to think that power over is the normative kind of power in the world. It is the power that builds human institutions. It is power created by human institutions. But all human institutions have a life cycle and they fade. All of them are temporary. And it is a deceptive view of the world to think that power over is the normative definition of power, and power from below is the exception, or what we do at Sunday school with children. In God's world, in the bedrock of the world as God defines it and views it, power from below, power through service, is normative, and power from above, power over, is a deception. It is real, and power over is not illegitimate, and it can be good. It can be used for practical purposes. But power from below is normative, defining, and more real. A friend of mine, John Stokes, died this past summer. He was 80 years old. As a young man, he worked as a physicist in the Defense Department. Later, he got involved in digital photography and was one of the leaders in the United States in developing applications and technologies for digital photography. He was the primary consultant to the National Institute of Health, to National Geographic, and to the Library of Congress on how to use digital photography to preserve culture and to preserve library collections. So I worked with him in my own work to digitize ancient manuscripts. His time was precious, he led his field, and he earned leadership in his field through a lifetime of hard work. But one day I was talking with him, and he said he couldn't be a part of a critical meeting. And the reason he couldn't participate in this critical meeting was that he was teaching vacation Bible school at his church. And he said that took precedence. John earned leadership through a lifetime of hard work, but he was forgetful, graciously forgetful of the status that he had earned. And that gracious forgetfulness defined him in God's eyes. And for him, power under, power through service, wasn't just what he did at Vacation Bible School. The fact that he could be forgetful of his earned authority that he had earned in his life showed that power through service, power from below, pervaded his life. It was the defining rule of his existence. Jesus exercised power through service and accepted the vulnerability that it entails. When you exercise power through service, you can be neglected or forgotten. Someone may not credit you for your contributions. You may be frozen out, in fact, of certain decisions. The Apostle Paul writes that he humbled himself even to death on the cross. Jesus didn't go to the cross because his identity as a servant made him weak. There's such thing as tough love. Tough love can confront someone with the consequences of their actions. He didn't go to the cross because he was weak, but because his efforts to restore people, people who were declared unworthy, and sometimes unworthy because of their own fault. But his efforts to restore people who were unworthy were upsetting the social order. Those who possessed power over felt that something had to be done about Jesus because his power from below was so effective. If you are a servant, people may misinterpret you. You may not be publicly thanked at the end of the year at the awards ceremony. But people aren't your audience. God is. God knows, and that's all that matters. The Apostle Paul writes in the New Testament, in the book, his letter of 2 Corinthians, that everyone who follows Christ is a new creation. The old has passed and the new has come. This is apocalyptic language. Old passing, new coming, being melted down and reconstituted. But Paul is applying it to people. Everyone in Christ is a new creation. The old has passed away. The new has come. Paul is inviting each of us to have a personal apocalypse. As a follower of Jesus, he is saying we need to be melted down and remade. He's inviting all of us this Advent to have a personal meltdown. And I'm sure that we will. Someone will take our parking space at the mall. The cat will climb the Christmas tree and break an heirloom ornament. Our children will run amok. But there's another kind of meltdown that we can have from Advent to Easter as we follow Jesus from birth through his public ministry to his death and resurrection. From Advent to Easter, Jesus invites us to melt down and be remade in his likeness.